From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
My problem as a collector of baseball cards was that I valued the cards of players I liked. Serious collectors value the cards that are valuable. Another problem was that I attached some of my cards to the spokes of the wheels of my bicycle with clothespins. Serious collectors pressed all their cards between sheets of plastic. My final problem is that the house I live in now has no attic. People who benefit from serious good fortune find a T206 Honus Wagner card tucked in the back of the broken bureau drawer in the corner of the attic. So maybe I wasn't the right guy to talk baseball cards with Michael O'Keefe and Terry Thompson, the authors of The Card, Collectors, Con Men, and the True Story of History's Most Desired Baseball Card. But I am a professional, and so this week, when I had the opportunity to talk with Michael and Terry, I soldiered on. I began our conversation by asking Michael to explain why the T206 Honus Wagner relic was not just another baseball card.
Well, one just sold for $2.35 million, so not too many cards go for that much change these days.
The card became known as the Gretzky T206 Honus Wagner because Wayne Gretzky co-owned it for a time. It was purchased by Bill Mastro from Alan Ray in 1985 for a mere $25,000. Has anybody ever established where Mr. Ray got it?
Well, $25,000 back then was a huge amount of money for a card. So Mastro, it was a good investment for him, but it really was a big significant amount of money back then. As we report in the book, this card was found, it was part of a sheet that was purchased in a flea market in Florida sometime in the early 80s.
Now, just for our listeners' understanding, a sheet is a whole bunch of baseball cards printed together that nobody's bothered to cut apart.
Right. Normally cards would be cut in the factory. They're printed in a big sheet and then they'd be taken off the printing press and taken to a cutting area where they would be cut and then, individually put into packs of cigarettes or tobacco. The deepest we got into this was that it was purchased in a Florida flea market for some ridiculously low amount of money, like $12 or $112.
The card had come from a printer's family. That's the story that we're told over and again, that it came from a desk in a printer's family. I think printers often ended up with these sheets. That's about all we know. We really don't know if it was sold or bartered back and forth or anything like that from the time it was printed.
Well, you say, Terry, that printers often ended up with these sheets. Did they have some kind of special power that enabled them to see that these things were not cheap, junky pieces of cardboard and that someday they would finance large numbers of college tuitions for somebody?
I'm sure they did not, but I think that if you've seen some of these sheets, which we have, and Michael Gidwitz, who owned the card in his collection, these are gorgeous, beautiful pieces of art. Sort of oddly enough, this card would be probably more valuable had it been left on the sheet. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah, I think that's one of the great tragedies of this story is that these guys find this sheet. And the Wagner card is preserved, has been able to stay in such great condition in part because it was in the middle of a sheet, and so the corners didn't get dog-eared or dirty, the edges didn't get ragged like they would with the baseball cards we collected when we were kids. But, the funny thing is that historically no one has ever seen a T206 sheet since, certainly in many, many decades. And so for a sheet to be out on the market right now, I know there's a lot of collectors that just say, well, boy, that is something we'd like to see. It would also tell us how these cards were printed. It would give us a real kind of, it would be like looking at fossils, the dinosaurs. You would kind of know how things were done and how people were thinking back in those days.
Well, that's a little bit of a stretch, don't you think? Fossils in the dinosaur age?
It's only a stretch in that it would be a clue as to how these were printed. Certainly they're not as old as a dinosaur fossil.
Even Honus Wagner
Right, even Honus Wagner, even me and Terry aren't that old.
I think if you see one of these sheets in person, you sort of get it. Hmm. It's like looking at a beautiful painting.
Now, manipulation and shady business is not unheard of in the baseball card dodge. Mr. Mastro, among others, has been accused of, quote, improving the Wagner card. What does that mean exactly?
You know, as cards got valuable in the 1980s, the pressure and the temptation to sort of restore cards became very great. Cards that were selling for a few dollars all of a sudden became worth hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars. There's all kinds of techniques with, you know, corners. If you know, collected cards when you're a kid, you know, the corners get really dog-eared. That's a really easy thing to happen. And so they build these corners up with like cornstarch and stuff like that. I mean, some of the techniques are amazing in just in terms of how sophisticated it is, how much work goes into it. But it's worthwhile because the value of a card can really increase significantly. They're graded now by grading companies, and the difference between an 8 and a 4 certainly for, you know, a Wagner T206 is you're talking, you know, more than $1 million, probably close to $2 million difference between a really good card like the one that just sold in February and a really nasty looking card.
Yeah, but wait a minute. By really good card, you may be meaning a card that has been doctored so well that you can't tell it's been doctored.
Well, that's right. I think the doctoring of the cards, as Mike was saying, has evolved over the years from just using people who would use magic markers or something like that to color in.
Oh, I love that. That's great.
I mean, I think they definitely did that to very sophisticated computer-generated forgeries. We don't believe this card has been colored or altered in its appearance, although, of course, we don't know that for sure. But we do believe it's been altered in its shape.
Hmm.
You know, I think Mike can talk a little bit more about that, how that process came about.
We believe that Alan Ray and a gentleman named Bob Sevchuk, who helped him broker the deal with Bill Mastro, the original guys who cut it from a sheet.
This is the $25,000 deal.
That's right. So several years pass, and then this card is sold at an auction, and Wayne Gretzky and his boss, Bruce McNall, who at the time owned the Los Angeles Kings, they buy it at the auction, and there's a lot of press attention around it. And there's pictures of the card all over the place. And Alan Ray sees these pictures, and he sees the press accounts, and he says, wait a minute, I'm looking at this card. This card has been altered. It's not in the same condition or same shape that I sold to Bill Mastro. And he had taken pictures of the card prior to selling it to Mastro, and he sent these pictures
to Sotheby's,
the auction house that conducted the auction. He sent them to McNall. You know, apparently these pictures are still floating around out there, and we've been trying to track them down, and we think we're close to that.
You write that collectors have, quote, improved cards. Card companies have printed lots of copies of mistakes to create instant collectibles. And allegedly, expert authenticators have accused each other of fraud in this business as well. How can anybody ever be sure that the card they buy is the real thing?
I don't think you can. I think the hobby is so unregulated now. The graders have conflicts of interest with the auction houses and the people who do the brokering. You might send in your card to be graded, and who knows what they do with it once they receive it. It's difficult for you to tell if that's really your card that comes back to you.
Mm.
I think there's all kinds of shenanigans that still go on. You know, one of the questions we're always asked is, how do you tell if you have a good card, if you have a valuable card? And that's like a really difficult question to answer. The experts that we talk to say, you know, go look through this book called The Standard Catalog of Baseball Cards. It's this massive book that will tell you if your card is valuable at all. You could then take it to a card shop, but you're taking a chance when you do that.
Somebody may present your card as not worth much, and in fact it's worth a lot, and they turn around and sell it for 100 times what they paid you for it.
I mean, that's exactly what Alan Ray said Bill Mastro did to him.
Right,
so,
with the Wagner card.
When Ray sold the card to Mastro, according to Ray, Mastro told him, this is off-center, it's a piece of garbage, who'd pay anything? But he still overpaid for it anyway. But then, you know, 2 years later, 3 years later, he sold it for $110,000, walked away from that deal and called a car dealership in California and said, give me a Mercedes, you know.
Well, he knew what to do with the money, no question.
That's right.
Now, The Wagner card most recently changed hands earlier this year. A collector named Brian Siegel sold it to somebody who wishes to remain anonymous. Does that person also wish to remain ignorant of the fact that he or she may have purchased something worth a great deal less than $2.35 million?
Well, we found it interesting that the sale took place right before a book came out. And we know that as we were writing this book and researching it, it caused a lot of problems in the hobby and a lot of controversy. I think we feel like the card was sold before it could be fairly well documented anyway, that it had been trimmed.
Hmm. But with all that said, I think there's one thing that's really amazing about it. You could say that this card was trimmed or it came from a sheet and it breaks all the rules of the hobby. I don't think it matters at this point. I think that it has gotten such cachet. It is still, you know, in the end, as we say in the book, it's such a great-looking card, even though it breaks all the rules. You know, these guys and just the mindset of these collectors, they're going to spend big money for it anyway. I don't see this thing bottoming out. I think this card will sell for more money the next time it sells than it sold. You know, it could go for $3 million next time it sells.
I think the controversy has added to its mystique and possibly to its value, but you can't really be sure about that now, because now it does have a bit of a question mark around it. I'm not sure anyone else is really going to want to pay that for it. I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, and it'll be interesting to see who exactly does own this card.
I think this speculation here is fascinating because you guys have also written in your book that the $2.35 million price tag for the Wagner card, notwithstanding, the baseball card collecting hobby is, quote, in critical condition. Why?
Well, it's just card companies and the auction houses and the dealers and the local retailers, it really killed the goose that laid the golden egg. I mean, card sales are down about 80% now from what they were in 1991. I'm talking about new cards and not the vintage cards. But basically what happened was, you know, Topps had a monopoly for many years, about 25 years from the early 50s until late 70s and early 80s. And that started to get challenged by a number of different companies, Fleer most prominent. Finally, a court ruled that this was an illegal trust and that the Major League Baseball Players Association, which granted the license to print cards, had to offer this to other companies too. So it's kind of like coffee. I think this is a good way to compare it. You know, it used to be you could get a cup of coffee for 25 cents in a local diner and it all kind of tasted the same. And, you know, there was no gourmet coffee. And then Starbucks comes along and they really changed the landscape of it. Upper Deck is the Starbucks of baseball cards. They made it much more sophisticated. They used sophisticated printing techniques and they started charging a lot of money for cards. And cards no longer became something kids did. It became something that people collected as an investment. And it was no longer something you could go to the candy store and pick out a pack and think, I think my favorite player is in this pack. Now you had to go, there's a guy with a glass case and a lock on that case, and you had to get him to go and open. It's like the comic book guy from The Simpsons. You got to go get him to open the counter and give you the pack. And you may not get the pack you want. They took the fun out of it. And, you know, kids have got all these options today. There's computers and video games, all this stuff. Who needs it? Who wants to spend $7 or $10 for a pack of cards when I can go play video games with my friends all day?
Michael O'Keefe and Terry Thompson are the authors of The Card, Collectors, Con Men, and the True Story of History's Most Desired Baseball Card, published by Morrow. They join me from NPR's New York Bureau. Michael and Terry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's been great. Thank you.
My conversation with Michael O'Keefe and Terry Thompson about The Card will be featured in this week's show. I'll also be talking with pro basketball writer Kevin Hench about what the Portland Trail Blazers are likely to do on Thursday when they have the opportunity to make anybody they like the future of their team. I'll check in with the U.S. women's soccer team as Christine Lilly et al. Prepare not only for the World Cup in September, but for the return of women's pro soccer to the U.S. in the spring. And we'll have a story about skiing in the desert, because what sports program would be complete without one of those? So join us, and remember, you can always listen to Only a Game at onlyagame.org.